Tonight I want to talk about just a wonderful resource that's underutilized. It's called Sympathetic Joy. It's one of the four Brahmaviharas. And when I pulled this talk together, pretty much all I could find in the Buddhist literature about sympathetic joy is that we don't use it enough. Philip Moffat said that for most people, sympathetic joy is often the most underdeveloped of the four divine abodes. However, when you can experience sympathetic joy, your happiness has 1,000 sources rather than just your own single point of happiness. And that's a wonderful way of putting it. But I think it greatly understates what sympathetic joy has to offer. 1,000? I think it's infinite. Because every sentient being then becomes a potential for your joy. There's an article on Access to Insight, which is one of the sites that I really respect and trust. It was written by four writers. It's a good scholarly article, but it's all intellectual. There's nothing in it about the heart. It just analyzes why we're usually deficient in sympathetic joy and says that we should develop it. But I don't want to slam that article because most of what I found out there takes the same approach. I think it makes a lot more sense, and it makes this phenomenon much more accessible if we can just feel it and recognize when we feel it, because we do in the normal course of our lives. But I don't think that we stop and recognize it and appreciate it. I think we could do a little more of that. So the approach I want to take tonight is by telling stories that I've written in my own education in the Brahmaviharas. And for those of you who are not familiar with them, they are, well, there's a Zen story that I really like. These rich guys came up to Buddha and said, "We love the idea of nirvana and what you're teaching, but really, I mean, shaving our heads, going out with nothing but a robe and a bowl, that's really not for us. Is there some way that we can get to heaven without becoming monastics?" And he said, "Oh yeah, there are four ways that you can live in heaven while you're in this lifetime. And they are loving kindness, sympathetic joy, compassion, and equanimity. All of these states flow from recognizing that sentient beings want to be happy, and yet we all suffer. And sincerely wanting all sentient beings to be happy, not to suffer." There's a wonderful prayer by Shantideva. The prayer goes, "May I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, and a healing medicine for all who are sick. For as long as earth and sky endure, may I assist until all living beings are awakened." That just makes my heart feel so good. I love that prayer. I can feel that. there is a comparable prayer in the Christian tradition, which you may know, it's the prayer of St. Francis. And I really like that too, except a few things. You know, I'll read over it and I'll go, oh, if I can understand that my way, I can get into that. But I'm just totally with Shanti Deva's prayer. I really, really long for all beings to be happy. And that, it's the greatest source of happiness. I know. The way I see it is these four divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity are like a boat. And metta, or loving kindness, is the prow of the boat. It sets the direction. It breaks the water. It takes us there. And to one side, where we encounter suffering, if the heart is filled with this desire for all beings to be happy, then when we encounter suffering, the heart's going to respond with compassion. And when we encounter a being that's happy, the heart's going to respond with joy. So it's kind of like, you know, the two oars on a boat, and the rudder is equanimity that holds us balanced, that keeps us steady, so that we don't just go in circles with the compassion or the sympathetic joy. All of the Brahmaviharas have a near and a far enemy. The far enemy is pretty obvious. The opposite of sympathetic joy is jealousy. Why is he happy? I deserve to be happy. You know, as if there's a finite supply gets passed out once a day and somebody else got my allotment. That's pretty easy to see and kind of talk ourselves out of. The nearer enemies are sneakier. And the one with sympathetic joy is that we're really kind of caught up in our own pleasure. There's something going on that we've got what we want, and we see somebody else that they've got what they want, and we think, oh, that's right, yes, I'm so happy that I've got what I want. So this ability to care that somebody else, some being, a dog, a cat, you know, the purr of a cat, that's what we cat people are hooked on, you know? Ooh, this being is happy. It resonates in our own being. So I'm going to start telling you a little of my story. There was a time in about 1992 when I decided this was it. Meditation, I was going to do it every day, going to take it seriously. And about a year and a half to 2 years afterwards, I read some works by Ram Dass and Stephen Levine about working with people who are dying. And I didn't really understand how it was going to work. I thought it was going to be sort of like Tuesdays with Maury, you know. You go and they give you all these little nuggets of wisdom and, you know, you got wise. But what it turns out to be is that it's just intensive schooling in the Brahmaviharas. I didn't know how I was going to go about doing this, and then within a week of deciding that I wanted to, in my mailbox fell a big postcard from the Zen Hospice Project inviting me and all the rest of the world to go take their 40-hour training, which I did. And this is an excerpt of a book I've been writing since 1998. And it's just going swimmingly. Thank you. Its main title at this point, the working title, is Dreaming Rachel And the subtitle is A Spiritual Journey Through Love at the Edge of Life. It starts out pretty much with taking a tour of Laguna Honda Hospital during this 40-hour training that I went on. The women's ward smells awful. The food odors are almost nauseating, and they're overlaid with the smells of urine, feces, and disinfectant in a mélange that cues my nervous system to flee. What a relief to end this tour in C2, the hospice ward. It is softened, friendly, much warmer than the other wards. People smile, chat with each other, laugh. An Asian woman is being moved in her wheelchair by a volunteer on duty, just being paid attention to. She is beyond speech, almost blind, but she waves her crippled hands at us, beckoning. One by one, we reach out, and she takes our hands, beaming. We stand around her in a circle of love, more joyous than any group at a party. Writing this, I am moved to tears. Then, I only felt joy to be part of that moment of happiness for her. Now I know I'm in the right place. So I finished the training and I was invited to spend my year at the guest house, not at Laguna Honda, but the 4-bed unit that's just kitty corner from San Francisco Zen Center. We were told that we were la creme de la creme of the training program. And once my ego settled down, I started having a really good time. I met Alan during the training. Like me, he was from the Midwest. Both he and I were very reserved. And even though I resonated with him. I was very attracted to who he was, and I wanted to be his friend, but it wasn't really kind of happening. So I said, all right, I'm going to do what I can to make this happen. And I asked him if I could take him Christmas shopping. And we actually had a wonderful time that day. I bought him a little surprise gift and left it by his bed. And when he came back from visiting his family, he was a little upset because he was dying of AIDS. And his family, even though they were warm, they would not talk about his life. He just couldn't share his life with his parents. And being a lesbian, I was able to, comfort him and be there for him. And as that conversation kind of developed, we acknowledged that we were friends. Unfortunately, it was in January, so just a week or two later, that he came down with meningitis. And he went down and was not conscious very much. And I began to grieve. I realized that I had lost this budding friendship. But the volunteer coordinator was a wonderfully wise woman who said, he's aware that you're there. Your presence is still very important to him. He knows who you are. And she suggested that I give him a manicure, which kind of scared me because I'd never done it except for a dog, and I screwed that up. So I was just really focused on the task. And by calming down, slowing down, just being really present, I could feel my feelings toward Alan change. I was just feeling our personal connection. Well, I'll read it. I was able on that day to see past my desire for Alan's affection to the essential nature that we shared. Focused on the simple but absorbing task, I began to speak my love for him with less self-consciousness. As I did so, my affection came to feel gentler to me. In fact, for the first time in my life, I felt my heart open freely without even caring if my gift of love was being received. Although it wasn't my shift, I went back to visit Alan 2 days later while his parents were there. When I arrived, they were sitting in his room, silent and stiff. They had been called to come, told that it was time to say goodbye. Nodding respectfully to them, I went directly to Alan's bed and kissed his forehead. He murmured and smiled, but didn't open his eyes. Then, as I turned slowly from the bed, I spoke to his mother. "He's a wonderful man." She rose from her chair and reached toward me for a hug. After that, I hugged Alan's father, too. He seemed surprised but grateful. Then I told them, "It's been a great experience working here, but the best part has been getting to know Alan." "Look," his mother said, "you're making him smile." And it was true. A wide smile lifted Alan's lips below eyes that were still shut. For about an hour, I sat with his parents, and we told stories about good times we'd had with Alan, how kind he was, and how we loved him. The depth of my affection seemed to make it easier for them to express their own deepest love for their son. When his father said, "I've always been proud of him," I looked over at my friend as if to share with him the wonder of that remark. The corners of Alan's lips were again lifted upward, and because of that smile, I felt sure he was at last hearing the love he'd never really felt from his parents. I moved to Laguna Honda after my year was up because the guest house had all these stairs and Laguna Honda was flat, and I can't go upstairs. I have a neurological disorder. So it was very different than the guest house. It was like 38 patients. It used to be an open ward, and you'd walk into it and you'd just see the common room and then bed after bed after bed vanishing in the horizon. And several, like half a dozen volunteers and maybe 3 or 4 CNAs who sort of resented us because there were fewer certified nursing assistants than there would have been if it hadn't been for the volunteers. And we spent a lot of time talking to the patients, which made them feel better, and the CNAs really respected that. But, you know, it did kind of impact their workload. But when it came to making the patients feel better, we all shared that. So it was on my first day that Anita, one of the CNAs, was showing me around, and she showed me this thin metal cabinet. You open it up, and here are all of these cotton weave warm blankies, they call them. Everybody called them that, keeping them nice and yummy for the moment that a patient in pain would want them. And I saw that, and I just grabbed one, and I said, "Oh, that'll make them happy." And I could see on Anita's face how delighted she was with my delight about the delight it would bring the patients. So that was sympathetic joy twice removed. I mean, the math is terrific here. It just can keep going. I'm going to move forward to after I'd been with the hospice for over 2 years. I was single, I went to a party, and the very reason that I went to the party happened. I met somebody. We really hit it off. Observers remarked about how well we were hitting it off. And then at the end of the evening, she told me that for the last 2 years, she had been dealing with ovarian cancer and had had 2 rounds of treatment. And by that time, I knew perfectly well what that meant. So I did a lot of soul searching and decided that if Rachel could cope with cancer, she could probably cope with me. And we fell in love. What can I say? The first year or so after we met started out hard. There was radiation. This was the last major intervention that was available. So they did that. It was hard. It was a hard recovery. But then after about 3 months, she rebounded and we went backpacking. We traveled. We just had a heck of a good time for about 9 months. And then the disease came back. Pain started moving down her leg. A pump was put in. There was a cerebral spinal fluid leak. It was tough. It was tough from about October to the 1st of January. Really, really dark. Plus, it was El Nino. It was the winter that had historic rainfall. You might remember it, 97, 98. The sun never came out. So in January, Rachel got back on her feet, went to a party by herself. I'll never forget her walking out of the house with the car keys in her hand, like, bye. And a few days later, well, anyway, again, I'll read that. During that winter, on most of the days, suffering and delight were all mixed together, just like threads in a tapestry. On a Monday in mid-January, the sun again came out in full glory. Rachel said she wanted to do a little retail therapy out in Emeryville. This exhilarating reprieve of the weather from what we'd had for months, that constant sound of rain beating against walls that never really kept out the gloom, the cold, or the damp. On this day, high puffy clouds shone brilliantly against a pale blue sky. We went our separate ways, then I turned to watch her stride toward the shoe store. No sign of pain showed in her gait, just the bounce of someone savoring the joy of life on a lovely day. As I watched, I treasured that vision. I knew I was observing someone I really cared about being happy, and I savored it. Because I had so much of the hardship that this was really obvious. But it isn't always so obvious. A couple of weeks later, I came home from a meeting, and Rachel said that she had some good news. She said, our rings are ready. We had decided that we would exchange rings in mid-February, even though it wasn't legal. We were going to do it. So we jumped in the car, and we drove right out to Lafayette, parked in front of the jewelry store's front window. The salesman who had taken our order saw us coming and went to get a ring box from the back room. A pale, thin man followed him out. Several employees watched as Rachel and I, laughing with excitement, opened the box and tried the rings on. We fussed about the sizing. Then we decided the rings were completely perfect. I asked the skinny guy if he was the jeweler who'd fashioned them. Oh no, he protested. I'm just an assistant. I came out to watch. Then he seemed shy. It's nice to see you so happy. Now, the weird thing was, this was 15 years ago, and things have changed. When we saw the whole jewelry, all of the employees watching us go in, we thought they were gawking at the queers. And when he said this, knowing that what he was experiencing was sympathetic joy, my own delight just burst the dam. It had no boundaries at that point. So this is a resource that feeds itself. Not only could he take advantage of our joy, but seeing him do that had the effect of increasing ours. Well, there's more. Someday the book will be out. I encourage you to get it. You know, these stories that I've been sharing with you are set, you know, as the subtitle indicates, at the edge of life. They're in situations where the topic could very well have been compassion. But it's not. It's sympathetic joy. And I do that here with you tonight and in the book to make this point that it's all mixed together. It's like a tapestry. And joy sometimes may be no more than a very thin gold thread in the midst of some dark colors. But we can pick it out and savor that, whether it's our joy or someone else's. The point is that when we open our hearts to the happiness of others, whether they're happy or not, their suffering touches us, and so does their joy. It all comes in, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And we see that it's not all just one or the other, but it's all the time it's mingled. And overall, there's a balance. That ancient saying says, 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. But as time goes by, and I can attest to this, what endures is the joy.